Talking about equanimity today seemed like a useful topic on a week which tends to be one of our national equanimity triggers, spending extended time with family. And it's something that came up a couple times in the foundational teachings class, and equanimity kind of tends to find itself on the last place on the list. And so in a class where you don't quite have enough time for the material, it tends to get not quite a full treatment. And so I wanted to make up for that today. I'm going to start with a poem from the Dhammapada. As a solid mass of rock is not stirred by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise and blame. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma. Virtuous people always let go. They don't prattle about pleasures and desires, touched by happiness and then by suffering. The sage shows no sign of becoming elated or depressed. So that's a very traditional, kind of old school Pali Canon description of equanimity. It's the analogy of the rock is a little unfortunate because it's easy to mistake equanimity. It's easy to think that equanimity is a matter of remove. Right, of a matter of kind of being cold and unaffected. And that's not what we're getting at. Equanimity is really vibrant, alive. But the stability of the rock is useful about that image. So as sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma, is a reference to the mechanism of equanimity, that it sees karma, right? It's not confused about cause and effect. And experiencing with that broader understanding is what allows equanimity to happen. So this is the seventh factor of enlightenment, it's the 10th paramita, it's the 4th of the Brahma Viharas. It's equanimity it protects us from the 8 worldly winds, right? Praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, and fame and shame. So those are the most common ways in which conditions change and we're our small self is vulnerable. And so if we're not equanimous, it hurts both directly and indirectly. You know, the directive is, you know, losing, if there's success happening, right? And that success goes away, then I feel suffering. Indirectly, if I'm attached to, say, praise, then I'm probably doing some kind of armoring around not feeling criticism, not hearing it, not receiving it, or developing a level of arrogance about, you know, believing what I tell myself or something like that. So those are more kind of subtle ways in which suffering happens by virtue of our being affected by the 8 winds. So equanimity is understanding that our access to contentment is independent of how those winds are blowing. Equanimity in Buddhism is most often brought up in relation to the 4 Brahma Viharas, Right, these are the four sublime states, divine abidings, whatever, there's lots of different words for it, immeasurables. But these are qualities that are always useful. They're always wholesome. It's always a good place to set the mind. And it's loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So these are inherent qualities, universal qualities that we can notice and relate to. And they're specific states of mind that we can cultivate and have them become more frequent and more intense, more accessible in a wider, broader range of situations. And they're also objects of meditation that we can specifically develop. And where I'm going today with this is that equanimity especially, but all the Brahmaviharas, this is experientially like what it's like when we're connecting to our deepest well-being, right? When we're really who we want to be, this is what it feels like. These are being expressed. And so as we sense the functioning of equanimity or metta, right, loving kindness, we're also experiencing our Buddha nature, right? It's the mode in which we encounter suchness in relation to others. So, zooming in a little bit on equanimity, just what equanimity means is the root, upekkha, is to look over or to look beyond, across. And so it's experiencing life from a higher vantage point, right? A broader perspective. The more integrated our understanding of how karma works, the more likely we'll be able to reliably function from a place of equanimity. There's, you know, so in the Buddhist tradition, things like equanimity are put in context, and there's all these like descriptors. So I'm going to give you some of the formulas that help situate it in relation to other states of mind. Equanimity is characterized by promoting neutrality towards oneself and conditions. Its function is to see situations and other people equally. Its proximate cause, like what immediately precedes it, is seeing ownerships of deeds. So that's the functioning of karma. Its near enemy is indifference. So if you're trying to be equanimous, but you miss, but you're close, then that's indifferent. That's like being like a rock, except cool, not stable, right? You know that it's successful when resentment and approval subside. You know that like grasping after, pushing away. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this, to spend time with this one, is that we all recognize it pretty easily. It's something that is both very familiar and fairly confusing, I find, for a lot of people. It's recognizable in that we respond to it when we're around it, right? There's a quality that when someone has a lot of equanimity, like how that rolls is pretty predictable. But I think our conception of that doesn't fit very well. So I'm hoping to clarify that some. One of the confusions is basically that, like, how fun it seems like it might be, right? And I think our basic assumption is that probably a good idea, but it's kind of maybe it's a little more like broccoli. Like, you're not like, ooh, equanimity. Like, it's more like, okay, equanimity. I would like more of that. I'm a good Buddhist. And I would say that that's a mistake. I like broccoli, but it's really, Shakyamuni made a big, he spent a lot of time on this, and his stance is that this is one of the highest kinds of happiness, right? It's still a conditioned happiness. It's still subject to situation and context, but the pleasure associated with equanimity is much higher than the pleasure associated with most conditioned phenomena. And the issue is that it's subtle, right? So it's difficult to discern. It's so easy to be kind of pulled towards aversion or pulled towards attachment. That middle ground between those, you know, it moves quick. And so that's where we're looking for that subtle sensation of equanimity. Part of the reason why it feels so good when you do notice it is that when our attention is getting tugged around, right, we're being coerced by preference, there's this kind of like frequency of disconnect that happens. So we're moving one direction, we have a thought, we're distracted, boom, and now we're moving in a different direction. The mode of being keeps changing. And so it creates this scatteredness, a sense of not being aligned, a sense of not being free, right? And that's a subtle layer of suffering, but it's pretty pervasive, and equanimity is the lack of that, right? Because when we're equanimous, when we're not getting tugged around by preference, by opinion, our attention lands on whatever is present, right? It's not, the flow of attention isn't dictated by who I think I am, by my preferences. And so we're willing to attend to pleasant or unpleasant subjects equally. And that feels wholesome because there's a freedom with it, right? I'm not getting coerced. It's natural. It's innate. And so when I feel that naturalness, I feel that alignment, then it feels expansive. It feels free. It feels ready and available. I feel like I have a lot to offer. So I can be generous with attention. I can give it to whatever is present, just because it's present, not because it fits with who I think I am. So it's not so much that it's dull or withdrawn or kind of dead. It's actually radiant, actually vital, And our concern that we don't really want that because I've got all this self built up about wanting things a certain way. And I'm really familiar with that, and I'm really well practiced at that. I don't want to give that up. I would say that that's an argument with the idea of equanimity, but it doesn't really apply to the experience of it. I think we have a little anxiety that equanimity is going to mean that we're cold or numb or something. But that's that kind of hesitation, that withdrawal from life, that indifference to life is actually aversion, right? That's not equanimity. When equanimity is present, there may be something aversive, but we're free to connect anyway, right? There's nothing in the way there. An equanimous mind accepts that pain is part of the world. It understands suffering and can be, you know, easily responsive anyway. Buddha said that an equanimous mind is abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So that warmth is really clearly pointed to, in contrast to the rock analogy. Equanimity is one of it supports and protects the other three Brahmaviharas, right? So the loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy is dependent on equanimity. So that's about it. And then how do we get more of it? Speaking of grasping. Zen is like one big trick question. Okay, so if equanimity is basically not getting pushed and pulled around by things, then the most straightforward approach is to developing this capacity is to investigate how I get pushed and pulled around by things. Right? It's the most direct, it's the most immediate. How is my sense of alignment or balance lost? The sense of lost. What sensations do I have? What do I tell myself? How does the world look? You know, that's what I want to be asking. The more clear I am about what it's like when I lose equanimity, when I get reactive, when I start to cling, the easier it is for me to step out of that rut, to do something different. Make a change in whatever my patterned response is. And so that can come by changing the situation or changing my internal state. And lots of different things to do there. As I'm able to do that more often, those pockets of flexibility and caring become more frequent. Right? They appear more often and they last longer. For myself, some situations are much more conducive to practicing with equanimity. If it's inconvenient, that's a good one. If it's surprising, that's also a good one for me. Can I set aside my opinion or preference in this instant? I can't find something that I'm looking for, or I'm receiving constructive criticism, or I see some pet peeve, or I don't know, waiting in line, something like that. You know, those are all like times when it would be more likely to lose equanimity, and so to know, like, oh, this situation is about to arise, like, try to turn on the curiosity in advance. Try to look for it. Look for how that's going to go. And so that's, if all goes well, it can happen like that. it's also useful to have some like red flag triggers, you know, things that like, oh, if I miss it, and if this train leaves the station, like that it's going to naturally, you set up some things like, if this happens, then I know I need to practice with equanimity. You know, so there's some, usually that's something that we set up after the fact, but it's good for the next time. So if it feels like it's too subtle to notice the rollout, if you have a reactive, you know, moment, you can still mind that. You can still like notice what you would do differently next time and give yourself that reminder. So what this is focusing on, like how equanimity goes away, right? And then that tends to be more productive than focusing on keeping equanimity. Keeping equanimity is usually ends up being a clinging to an ideal, right? To sort of, I've been playing with stucco a lot recently. So like adding plaster or cement to some concept, making it more and more of a thing. And if we're parroting that concept of equanimity, if we're trying to like match that, if we're trying to read that script, is more artificial, right? It's not, we're running a much higher risk of veering into the near enemies of indifference or remove or complacency. There's a version that of this that happens with new practitioners, especially enthusiastic new practitioners. It's called Bampu Zen, I believe. And there's the character of it is that there's a forcefulness about it, right? It's a grasping the will and forcing yourself to not make a mistake, or forcing yourself to not fall asleep in Zazen, or whatever it may be, whatever the thing is, like, you know, like forms in the Zendo for someone doing this are going to be extra rigid. And it can work with something like equanimity, but it's not a long-term answer, right? It's not really a sustainable strategy. Willpower is not a long-term fuel. It's more of a short burst kind of thing. Karma's going to win. And the downside of like trying to get by on like, you know, sprints of willpower is that when we're doing that, we're not that receptive, right? We have to block everything else out, and so we're not learning. We're not gaining the information that comes from seeing our experience with subtlety. So to really receive that, there has to be this mode of acceptance, this acceptance of my experience as it is. And if you're looking at your practice over the long haul, you know, you need as much of that information as possible. So start from acceptance. So two strategies so far, right? Clinging to ideal and noticing where it goes off the rails. A third strategy is focusing more specifically on the state of mind. And so this is picking times when like you realize you're gonna need it, right? And this can be in the midst of a situation. I'm looking for my, whatever, I'm looking for my pen, right? And I can't find it. I realize like I'm starting to get agitated. Oh, shift state, right? That can be just, you know, a deep breath. When you need to really delve in more there, I find that it's useful to have a high watermark, you know, have some example of when you really felt equanimous in a full, thorough kind of way. And Remember that. Remember what that was like, who you were in that moment, what things looked like, how the vantage point was different. And if you can pull that up, even though it's a memory, there's something of that which is present, and that can shift. It can change who you are in that moment. It's like those little cairns alongside trails in the mountains that, like, you know, you find that and you look around and like, oh, that's what it looks like from here. So when you have those moments of dropping in, of feeling really, a really broad view, like, look around, take stock. That's a cairn for you. You can come back to that. You're going to need it at some point. How is this different? What's it like? And then a fourth mode of cultivating this might be, you know, the most explicit, using it as a meditation, right? So, like, meta-meditation is often done by kind of reciting a phrase, may you be happy, may you be at ease, something to that effect, and finding that feeling for yourself and then gradually broadening that. The same basic pattern works for equanimity, but instead of creating the sensation of loving kindness, you're creating the sensation of equanimity. And so the cues for that have more to do with how karma works, right? That because that's the, what's it called? Proximate cause is understanding of karma. So phrases associated with that are, basically what it is a matter of recognizing that someone else's situation, I may have my relationship to it, but their situation depends on their intent, right? Karma, their karma is working out. So regardless of my wish for you, your happiness is not in my hands. All beings are in charge of their own karma. May you do what needs to be done to find happiness. That's a traditional equanimity meditation. So, in Zen, so far, this has kind of been a Vipassana-ish talk of flavor. So now I'm going to get to the good stuff. I'm just teasing. This is, equanimity is an important one for Zen, I would say. Part of the deal with, one of the differences to Zen practice as it's traditionally and present day taught and practices, that it's very communal, right? We really emphasize that aspect of it. We're interdependent, and our enlightenment arises in relationship to those around us. So there's no way to get away from that web of relationships. It's like practice is embedded within that. You know, the one of the primary vehicles for teaching Zen is, you know, the koan stories. And those are all about relationship. How is it proved? How is it seen and recognized? A lot of the forms that we do are about seeing and recognizing each other in our, not just in the, I mean, there's layers, right? There's, first of all, we have to recognize ourself, and then we're recognizing a specific other, and then a broader other, and then maybe a universal other, and then the more transcendent, right? So that recognition of relationship gets deeper and deeper. And so equanimity matters because it helps set the container, right? When we encounter a reservoir of equanimity, someone with a lot of practice, you know, you can feel that presence, and it creates a sense of security. And we need that to do this, right? We need to have that sense of safety around us to do this kind of work, because it's risky. Practically and psychologically, right? That progression of the field of what matters getting bigger and bigger parallels, like what happens with a metta meditation. You know, expanding out, first I'm doing metta for myself, and then my, you know, immediate friends and family, and then broader and broader circles, until it's as inclusive as I can get it, as I can feel it. So practice is happening within this mandala between us all, right? There's this field of impact and influence that we're all aware of and all influencing. It's a manifestation of interdependence. It's a manifestation of non-separation. We may or may not see it like that, but that's part of what's happening. It's a layer of truth. And when you see that, equanimity really matters. It makes the whole thing resonant. Part of, you know, for the foundational teachings classes, we've been ending with Mondo, doing this kind of public dialogue where someone will present a little snippet of Dharma, some verse, and those present will challenge them on it, will ask them questions on it. And part of what that does is it makes this mandala explicit, right? A correct answer is not one that is the most orthodox, right? A correct answer is one that where there's this sense of arrows meeting in midair, right? It's about the relationship. It's about the interaction effect. You can see people who are learning how to do that, learning how to do Mondo, like they'll get a question and they'll look up. They'll try to find the correct answer by testing it with like what they know about Buddhism, and does this agree? And it's not it. Go inside. Look inside. Or look to the person who asked you the question and see what's needed and just respond to that. Those are two routes which are valid, which are useful, right? Not just in Mondo, this happens in life too. Same thing in Zazen, you know. It's not about the content of our thought. It's not about all this stuff that arises. It's all going to drop away. But who are we in relation to that? What's the space through which that's moving? Who holds the thoughts? It's extra obvious during Sesshin. We sit here together. We create a Buddha field of intention, commitment, stillness, equanimity. We all rely on that emergent presence. It's palpable. You can come to Sesshin late or part-time and walk in and you can feel it. There's a depth that's happening. and you're affected by it. You can be held by it, supported by it. So Rahatsu is coming soon. It's a good time to go looking for high water marks in your equanimity practice. So please join us for some bit of it. Thank you. Any questions or comments?
Thank you for your talk, Kokmyo. I really love this subject. It's very interesting, all the things you've said. I'm hoping that you can help me connect the dots on something. Mm-hmm. In the Plum Village tradition with Thich Nhat Hanh, he describes the Brahma Viharas as practicing true love. Mm-hmm. He sort of changes, well, not changes, but he translates it in a certain way, in equanimity in particular. He calls it interbeing or interconnectedness. Mm-hmm. And I heard you touch on that a little bit. You know, I think I can't quite remember, but something about being in Sangha and becoming closer, that kind of thing. Yeah. I'm wondering if you could talk a little more about that, about practicing interconnectedness and what that has to do with equanimity.
Sure.
Thank you.
So if you take the root of equanimity, meaning to look across, to look over, the higher your vantage point, the more you can see, the less the sense of separateness. Right, there's just more there, and so our own like distinctness is less. I think that's the simplest way to connect those two dots.
When contemplating that, if something is, maybe when something comes up, would you recommend sort of a looking across this thing that's in front of you? It's like a practice point.
But I would say try different versions of looking across. So, for me, if I'm struggling with something that I'm already knotted around it, it's already got me, and I'm trying to like salvage some shred of equanimity, then usually I have to like cast around a bit. So, I might try, like, okay, what does this look like 100 years from now? Right, like. Not a big deal, right?
It's a good one, yeah.
Yeah, so that's one vantage point. Try that one out, and then you know you could come up with a couple of different things that might be a different way of seeing the same situation.
Thank you. That's great. Appreciate it.
Angel Kyoto Williams made a remark the other day that. You probably also heard, mm-hmm. which I found interesting, which was something to the effect that a respectful distance, respectful and also caring distance can often be a lot better than a totally dysfunctional proximity. I thought there was something to be said in favor of that, but it also appears as if it could also be a paradox in the sense of what you said now, which is that we have to develop equanimity in relationships, otherwise it's not terribly meaningful. And so
I can help there.
Okay.
Yeah. So I agree with Angel on that one. Like that's, you know, the point about equanimity being the support and the protector for the other three, right? That's what it's getting at. Like, that's, you know, her way of saying the same thing. When I say in relationship, that's acknowledging non-separation, right? It's not saying that, like, I have to have like some kind of artificial intimacy with everybody or like proximity or something, right? Like there's lots of different relationships in this room. And like the goal is to have those be like wholesome and clear. And, you know, like it's not that I'm married to everybody here, right? Like that's a particular relationship, you know? So, Is that helpful?
Yes. I guess the challenge in my mind comes about when you already are in some relationship that is intimate. I mean, you know, there's all this, you know, business that, like you were kind of, I think, suggesting about dealing with the karma of families this time of year, and how do we figure out when we're too close or when we're too far away? How do we negotiate that balance?
Yeah.
How do we know when we're doing it right?
Well, yeah. So I would soften the clenching around getting it right, and I would replace it with a curiosity and an acceptance of like, what's this like, right? And so let yourself be guided by sensation, you know, and if something's happening, someone's saying something, and you feel yourself, you know, starting to lose touch, starting to like get vague and hazy or something, then like, you know, like, okay, something about this relationship is not working for me, and I need to somehow reset. I need to change a boundary or something. So like, let yourself be surprised, but stay connected to that ongoing like source of information, right? Which is your experience, rather than keep, you know, continually trying to like revert to your idea of what it should look like.
Thank you.
I get really confused by when I think about equanimity. I don't know if I know what it feels like in my body, and I think that like I get confused, like I go to that numbness thing, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. like feeling nothing or feeling calm. That's equanimity. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know what it is. I feel also a resistance to it because it doesn't always feel authentic, if that makes sense.
It doesn't always feel, what doesn't feel authentic?
Well, I guess it doesn't feel authentic because,
What's the referent right there?
What's the what?
What's the referent? What's it in that?
I don't know. I don't know what equanimity is, Gokumyo.
Okay. I thought you were backing yourself into it for a moment there, but you got away. Rats. Okay. So so when you are witnessing your son go through the foibles of early adolescence, like, you know, you care, right? There's a warmth to what you want to happen. You want him to be happy. But you're not enmeshed in the situation, right? You know that, like, okay, this is a phase and do-do-do and whatever. You can see more of the situation than he can. That's an example of equanimity, potentially, right? That's a place that I would, for you, that where I might look to see if you can, like, find one in there. Is that plausible?
Yeah, but unsatisfactory. I'm not answering my question.
We'll take it today. I'm okay with that.
I just wanted to mention, I really liked your analogy of the warm rock, because that really hit it for me. I, too, also feel like there's this constant kind of swinging of the pendulum between being, you know, down in the trenches, really engrossed in the daily anxieties, and then whoosh, back to the cold stone, you know, like, you know, I have no feelings kind of person.
Right.
And neither of those are sustainable.
Yeah.
So I like that kind of idea of take that kind of stone idea, but add back in the compassion, add back in the things that you talked about, you know, equanimity protects. So I'm trying to use that as my own concept now.
Yeah, I think it's easy to, you know, when we're like engineering, when we're trying to like imagine our practice except better, you know, we tend to like isolate things, and it's not how it really works.
Thank you.
Thank you for your talk. This may or may not match what the subject is today, but I've been in the last handful of days just sort of checking myself out about what's going on in here. And I recently heard some of my most favorite music that I hadn't listened to in a really long time. And it was like, oh, you know, nice, you know, like a warm bath or like being in the ocean or something like that, just a nice sensation. And so I've been just checking myself out, like especially in the morning, I wake up, there's music in my head mostly. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's an earworm, you know, I keep hearing it and it's not driving me crazy like an earworm can, but it's like those notes in that song, I just feel like I'm kind of bouncy, you know, and it's like, what, me? You know? Mm-hmm. And so when I go through my Rolodex of all my emotions and, you know, stuff that upsets me and stuff I want to get pissed about or, you know, and that's mixed into with the one card of my Angovao, which is right speech this time.
Mm-hmm.
Noble silence pops up a lot. I think there's a connection there, the equanimity that you're talking about. And like, what's, you know, I just ask myself, what's really going on in your head right now?
Mm-hmm.
Is it that nice bouncy music that makes me happy, or am I just like really, you know, PO'd all over again, or, you know, like, or depressed, or, you know, not worth anything to anybody, you know, that, all
right,
those cards
right
in the file. Would you like to speak to that?
Sure. I think what I would say there is that like part of what's useful about equanimity is that it adds detail. Like we see more of ourselves when that's present. And so these subtle distinctions, like it's just going to get drowned out if there's not enough acceptance. And you know, part of what I was hearing, like with the Rolodex part, is that you know, things can escalate, right? And you have a, you know, there may be a dislike of this, but then there's the layers of like criticizing the dislike and why can't I do it like that, and you know, like so it when that's happening, there's not enough, we don't have the clarity to really see what's happening. We just, then there's kind of this sludge and, you know, we've got to let that subside. I think that notice with the bouncy music whether you're being pulled towards it or pulled away from it, right? And my sense is that there's a pulling towards, but like attending to that quality and seeing if you can like enjoy that without getting pulled, right? Is that useful?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Maybe two more.
If the near enemy of equanimity is indifference, mm-hmm. I was thinking about one of the strategies you talked about is investigation, mm-hmm. kind of like when you get pulled around. It seems like maybe a near enemy to investigation might be intellectualization or analysis or thinking that you can figure it out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yeah, sure. That's especially what happens. So there's kind of a point of divergence after you notice something. You can either sort of sink into that noticing, which feels like a kind of acceptance, and then it gets richer, or you can go towards explanation, which feels like you're going up. And so, you know, watch for that. And I think, you know, part of the reason we go up is that there's this sense of kind of urgency, kind of like sort of this sort of subtle restlessness or obligation that like it has to sort of be done. It has to be fixed. And we get that sense of, oh, it's fixed. We think we'll get that sense of, oh, it's fixed once we can explain it. But actually that's not really what happens, is in my experience, is that like my explanation never really feels like it captures it. And whereas if I go towards acceptance and it gets richer, the situation, my relationship to it changes, and I feel like a deep kind of satisfaction.
Thank you.
Speaking of acceptance, one equanimity practice that I was given is like when the tray of cookies comes around during sushi, and just take the one that's closest to you and don't try to pick the best one. And and that was very freeing, actually. Like, oh, I'm not seeking around, or like I'm not afraid I missed out on the best uh-huh. cookie. And so thinking about that as applies to life, like, okay, acceptance of what, like the cookie is a gift, you know, mm-hmm. it's like an amazing gift that comes around. And in life, like, these things are given to me, right? But and that feels like hard sometimes, but like that's an equanimity practice. But what about like seeking for things that I want, or you know mm-hmm. what I mean, like versus just accepting what's given, like how to find equanimity with that, or is that even relevant to equanimity?
No, I think it is relevant because, you know, it's easy to talk about equanimity in really simple examples, like, you know, to cookie or not to cookie, right? But, sorry. But life gets really nuanced and layered and complex. And so I think what I find is that there's varieties of wishing for something, And there's some versions of that which are expansive and connecting. And usually that's because I'm really connected to my experience, and there's a, like, what I'm kind of yearning for in that moment is in alignment in kind of a deep way, right? It's really serving my life. And that feels very different than the more kind of graspy, preferential, more idea-driven kinds of wanting. And you know, if you have a big decision, like, you know, should I move to Minnesota? or whatever. you know, there's going to be, you know, there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of mind moments involved there, and each one is going to, like, every time it comes up, every episode of considering this, you're going to have multiple different, you know, kinds of grasping, kinds of, you know, wanting. And so it's a matter of, okay, like, seeing it over time, bringing acceptance to the question, not, like, giving it time to resolve with greater and greater clarity. And as that happens, you can pick them out. You can see, like, okay, this whole category, like, I don't want to be a person who decides from that state of mind. This is what it feels like. It feels grippy and shifty, and that's not really who I am. And as you sift through that, like, what's left becomes more and more obvious, and you can attune to that aspect of the question easier.
Thanks.
All right, we are out of time. Thank you very much.